For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Well, the NBA world is still mourning the loss of Bill Walton. The NBA world, college basketball, broadcasting, the Grateful Dead fandom, you know, the communities he lived in. Everyone is mourning the loss of Bill Walton, one of sports' most interesting people, who died on Monday at the age of 71. So we'll be talking primarily about Bill Walton on this edition of the Sports Media Watch podcast. My name is John Lewis. I'm joined, as always, by Drew Lerner. Please subscribe at the SMW podcast feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. Well, let's go ahead and, start talking about Bill Walton, a larger-than-life figure. You know, I mentioned in a previous podcast episode that when I went up to All-Star Weekend this past year, I did have the opportunity to see Bill Walton in person. I did interact with him. I mean, it's not like we had a conversation. It was very quick interaction. Told him I'd seen him on TV my whole life. We fist bumped, which was pretty cool. I don't do a lot of events because I write about media. You don't really have to go and cover sporting events. So for me, I knew this was probably going to be the only time I'd ever actually see Bill Walton in person. But I never would have thought that he would pass away so quickly. There was no indication to people on the outside that Bill Walton was anything other than in excellent health. He looked the same as always. You could not have sold me on the idea when I saw him that he would be, you know, dead within 3 or 4 months. Obviously, he was keeping a lot of his struggles private. So it wasn't a surprise, however, because once that story came out, I think it was Awful Announcing, it was first reported during the year, and Bill started missing a lot of games. Pretty clear, Bill Walton's not missing a lot of games, and this radio silence about his status without it being something serious. So it wasn't a surprise in the context of that, but certainly earlier this year would have been shocking to think about. Drew, I'll bring you in.
Yeah, I mean, certainly just a shocking headline to see. Of course, with him being private about the matter, it's not something you're expecting, right? And 71's a young age to pass away, but he was a larger-than-life figure, and he did run in so many circles. You know, what you got a taste of on Monday and into Tuesday as well is just how everyone has a story about him. He touched so many people's lives, and from a broadcasting perspective, he actually had a pretty prolific career as well. He called NBA finals. He was legendary with his antics during college basketball, obviously lifted up the Pac-12 and the Conference of Champions moniker, you know, to new heights. So he really, I mean, I don't think broadcasting is really the headline of his career, but that's how most of us, sports fans kind of had our, you know, parasocial relationship with him, as it were. So I think that's how a lot of people in our circles, at least, John, see him and remember him. But he was so much more than that.
Well, he did broadcasting for 30 years. You know, he did it for 30 years. CBS, NBC, ESPN, and ABC. That's 3 out of the big 4 broadcast networks and ESPN, you know. He was ubiquitous. It's so interesting, because in my perception, the Pac-12 stuff is a relatively recent thing. But he worked with Dave Pasch for as long as NBC had the NBA. He worked with Dave Pasch for 12 years. And that was his primary broadcasting relationship, was with Dave Pasch, not with Steve Snapper Jones and Tom Hammond. It was with Dave Pasch, not with Ralph Lawler, with the Clippers. Dave was all over the coverage yesterday in a way that play-by-play voices rarely are. Dave's been doing the conference finals, so he was available for that to be in front of a camera. And it's just interesting. You know, that's his primary TV relationship. For me, his primary TV relationship was always Steve Snapper Jones, right? But, you know, really, it ended up being Dave Pasch. And that partnership that seems so recent, now it's all in the archives. All of it is, you know, past. I suspect they weren't going to work together again anyway, because the Pac-12 was ending. I know Bill would have continued to do games. I can't imagine he would have stopped doing games. But I suspect that the Pash-Walton thing was probably going to end just out of necessity. A lot of those Pac-12 teams, ESPN doesn't have the rights to anymore, right? You know, it's a shame they didn't get to finish the way that they wanted to. It's kind of like with Richard Lewis on Curb, although he got to tape all the episodes, where, you know, it would have been nice if Richard would have been alive for the end of the show was ending anyway, you know?
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think for people of my generation, John, just a little bit younger than you, you know, he's almost certainly associated with college basketball more so than the NBA. You know, I came of age at a time where, you know, I saw Bill Walton because I was staying up late, you know, red-eyed watching a 11 p.m. tip-off in the Pac-12. And honestly, he was more the event than the game itself, which of course was pretty polarizing for some, right? I would always talk with my father about how he is an amazing commentator if you're watching a game that is not your team. But when he's calling your team, it's a little like, all right, Bill, I actually kind of do want to hear about the game. But no matter what, he was a joy to listen to. Just the eclectic interests in his life. You know, I've had his autobiography sitting on my bookshelf for the longest time, and I haven't touched it. And now, like, I almost feel like I need to go back and read that just to hear from him, Bill himself, how he, you know, went about his life and how he, his perspective on the sport of basketball, but also his interests in broadcasting on all of it.
Yeah. And of course, his 30 for 30 that I did have the opportunity to watch when it debuted last year, just about a year ago, in the summer of 2023. And, you know, Walton had a very interesting life. That documentary goes into detail about his dealings with, you know, the Patty Hearst scandal in the 70s. I mean, he was obviously an important cultural figure long before he ever stepped in front of a microphone or a camera. He's there's so many different chapters to his life. It's really something else. And yet he did die at a very young age. You know, you think about Hubie Brown doing games at 90. I don't think Bill Walton was ever going to do games at 90. But I do think Bill Walton would have been active at 90 doing whatever, you know, if a 90-year-old can get on a bike, not sure. Maybe Dick Van Dyke is doing that right now, right? But if a 90-year-old can get on a bike, Bill Walton would be on a bike. He'd be going out doing all the things that he loved to do. And, you know, when you think about it, he lived a very full life. But he probably would have continued to be an active part of all of this for another, at least another decade before he would eventually, you would think, have to slow down. Maybe he would never have slowed down. You know, that's just the way that it goes, unfortunately.
I mean, he definitely never showed any signs of slowing down while on the air or in any of his public appearances. But I'd be remiss not to mention some of the television coverage of his death that broke yesterday as we record on Tuesday morning. ESPN was actually quite fortunate, I believe, that the NCAA Men's Lacrosse Championship had been delayed in a weather delay, and they were able to cut in with SportsCenter during that coverage window to talk about Bill Walton's death. Matt Barry anchored the coverage, and I thought he did a pretty phenomenal job handling the interviews with Jay Billis and then later Stephen A. Smith, really giving them time to reflect on the life of Bill Walton. It's always an interesting situation to cover a breaking news event like that, especially when it's a pretty unexpected death. You know, they probably didn't have a Bill Walton obituary ready to go and fire out to the world right then and there. You can't expect that when he's only 71. So in some pretty trying circumstances, you know, the other aspect of this, John, is it was a holiday, so they probably had a pretty limited staff there. But they did a pretty good job at covering Bill Walton's death in the immediate aftermath.
Yeah, I agree. I will say they probably did have an obit ready, maybe not updated. You know, they'd have to update it with fresh information. But, you know, Bill, with all the health issues he's had, and he's just such a significant figure in the sports world that, you know, they've got to have something ready to go. And if you want to be technical, Sports Century is kind of that. I mentioned that on social media yesterday. That was the documentary series ESPN debuted around the time of the new millennium, you know, just chronicling the lives of the great athletes of the 20th century. And so that kind of works as an obit for a lot of these folks, because a lot of them were long retired by the time Sports Century came on. So a lot of Walton's life would have been recapped in that, hosted by Chris Fowler, aired on ESPN Classic. But ESPN always does a great job with obituaries, with athletes' deaths, particularly athletes of the caliber of Walton. Athletes from the era where we made stars and personalities, right? ESPN always does a great job with that. You know, I hardly ever watch SportsCenter. I did watch, you know, I stayed up all the way for the Scott Van Pelt One Big Thing. Scott likes to put that one big thing at the end of the 90 minutes. You know, do that at the top. But hey, he got me to stick around all the way through all 90 minutes. You know, you want to see what they're going to say. ESPN still has the ability to do the things that ESPN used to be really good at, that historical context, but really only when athletes have passed. And, you know, I do think it matters when an athlete was active. Those were more consequential times, even though serious things are going on now. They were more consequential times than the 60s and 70s. The death of an athlete like Walton or Muhammad Ali has a certain weight, you know. I'm not saying that like Kobe's death didn't have weight. Obviously, it was a horrible, horrible tragedy, but it was mainly because it was a horrible, horrible tragedy. You'll notice that when we kind of chronicled Kobe's life, the history, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the same level of rich history. One, he was 41 years old, but two, also kind of the last 20-ish years, it's just not the same kind of life that Bill Walton and Muhammad Ali were fortunate and unfortunate to have to live, because it is a great privilege to have come of age in, say, the 80s or 90s or 2000s, when things were way less, you know, dramatic than they were in the 60s and 70s. But I definitely think that that particular crop of athletes, and we're losing so many of them, that particular crop of athletes where the obituary will inevitably involve a picture of Abdul-Jabbar and Jim Brown and Ali, you know, at that athlete summit, right? And that particular generation of athlete, when they pass, it's almost like you're learning a history lesson in a way that is maybe not the same for athletes from before or after.
I wanted to get your opinion on how ESPN handled coverage of Bill Walton's death during the pregame and game broadcast of the Eastern Conference Finals last night.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I hardly ever watch NBA Countdown, and I don't need to go into the reasons why. I did a whole article about it last week. But I did watch their tribute to Bill Walton. And I will say, you know, one, Wilbon is a very interesting character, because I don't really get why he's on the pregame show generally. And then when he's on PTI, it's like, it's feast or famine with Wilbon. He's on the pregame show and you don't know why he's there. He's on PTI and he's way over the top. You know, when something like this happens, you get kind of the ideal Wilbon, who brings a perspective and has, you know, in his mind, all of these experiences covering these athletes, watching them play. And he brings such value in these types of discussions. And I will say, even Stephen A., you know, I had forgotten that Stephen A. worked with Bill Walton. I had forgotten, I'd said in my big takedown of ESPN's NBA coverage the other day that Stephen A. was off that pregame show after 2006. But I was wrong. I had forgotten that Stephen A. had done that show again in 2007. What happened that year was it was supposed to be Stephen A., Walton, and Stuart Scott. And I remember writing about this on the site, you know, being snarky and, 18, 19 years old. Obviously, we know the public personas of Walton, Stephen A., and Stuart. And so they were going to debut on Halloween night, and my headline was "A Nightmare Studio Team on Halloween Night." And obviously, I feel kind of bad for that now because two of the three of them are gone. But, you know, I mean, I don't know how that was going to work. How are you going to have Stephen A. and Walton fighting for airtime? And Stuart Scott, who obviously was a big personality in his own right, I don't know how that was going to work. But we never got to see whether it would work. Stuart got cancer that year, and Bill had his back problems that year. But Stephen A. did, I think, an admirable job of kind of going back into the archives and talking about their relationship and the time that they worked together, as short as it was. One thing that Stephen A. mentioned, I think Wilbon did too, was that Bill was in such physical pain at that point in his life, he'd have to lie down. You know, you think about how much people are suffering and they don't let it show on the air. Because one thing they would say about Stewart is that toward the end, anchoring SportsCenter, Stewart was so tired. You know, he could barely keep his eyes open during commercial breaks. And he comes back and he's got the energy. It's really amazing, but also very sad at the same time. And, you know, I thought they did a good job. It's one of those things that you're going to be different talking about the death of a friend or a colleague than you are just talking about a game. So I think they did a good job. I thought they did a good job talking about it on the game telecast as well. Bill and Mike Breen worked a lot. Like, people don't really remember that. But who was on the call when Ron Artest went into the stands? It was Mike Breen, Bill Walton, and Jim Gray. Bill and Jim Gray worked together forever. And Breen and Walton worked together on NBC forever. They did a good job addressing it on the game telecast as well. And I'm glad there was some good mention of Snapper Jones, who Dave Pasch was Bill Walton's primary foil at the end. But Snapper Jones, to me, it'll always still be Walton and Snapper Jones. You know, maybe it's Tom Hammond working with them. Maybe it's Greg Gumbel. You know, maybe it's Marv Albert at the end of the NBC days, or even Musburger and Tirico. People forget. ABC eventually brought on Snapper Jones, and he and Bill did some games for ABC. I think the last game they worked together for ABC would have been, you know, sometime in the 05-06 season. So pretty recently, and they were working with Tirico on that. So that's the primary relationship that I think of when I think of Bill.
When it comes to Bill Walton's broadcasting career, John, there were certainly some controversial moments as well. And I know you outlined a little bit of that in your article on Sports Media Watch. Why don't you discuss some of his more high profile controversies on the air?
Yeah, well, not necessarily controversies. What I really want to address is Bill Walton from the last stretch with Pasch and on the Pac-12 is very different than Bill Walton on the NBA. Bill was not a teddy bear always talking about peace and love. Like, he could come out and really give you some sharp elbows. He was very critical when he was doing the NBA and NBC. Not a criticism of him to say that, but just simply to say, when Bill was calling the NBA finals, he wasn't talking about the dirt in Temecula, right? He was very straight-laced in those NBC days, wore a suit and tie, and really would sometimes let players have it. Like, I think Shaq, all the way up to the end of Walton's life, Shaq was still disparaging Bill Walton, because Walton would come after Shaq with criticisms when, he was doing NBA games for NBC and later ESPN and ABC. Walton had that thing with Larry Johnson at one point. This is in the 99 finals, and Walton called Larry Johnson a sad human being during one of the games. Like, Bill was not afraid to get down and dirty sometimes. That's not a criticism of him. It's not. It's simply to say that, you know, he was a real broadcaster. He wasn't just comic relief. He did, you know, for most of his career, he did real analysis. I loved what he did with Dave Pasch, but for most of his career, he did real analysis and sometimes said things that players didn't like. We, on the podcast, when Bill first got sick, we played the criticism that Bill levied of Shaquille O'Neal heading into Game 7 of the 2000 Western Conference Finals, right? That's the Bill Walton that I think of more so than the more eccentric one. I will say, I loved the eccentric Bill Walton. It was great. It's really sad to think, and it would have been the case anyway. It would have been the case anyway. But it's sad to think that there will never be another time where you stumble upon a Pac-12 game and it's like, hey, I wonder if Bill Walton's doing this game. If he is, I'm going to stick around for a little while. You never know when these things end, right? You never really have any idea when they're going to end. Sometimes people get to have their farewell tours, you know, and Walton in this case, he was going to have a farewell tour and he wasn't able to make it to that. They were going to have their farewell. I mean, like I said, the main Pac-12 teams that Walton would cover were going to Fox. He wasn't going to be able to do those games anymore unless he went to Fox. Maybe he could have done an Arizona game or two or something. I don't know, because ESPN still has the Big 12. But it was going to end anyway. It's just really sad that it didn't get to end on better terms, certainly.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, John. Obviously, there's a lot more we could say about Bill Walton, but I think it's about time that we move on and do a little bit of a ratings roundup to close out the show.
Yeah.
Let's start with a couple positive ratings stories. We had the Indianapolis 500 over the holiday weekend, a 4-hour weather delay.
Yeah.
Perhaps resulted in a little bit of a boost for NBC. The start time of the race was more in the late 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. hour, and the race averaged 5.34 million viewers for NBC. That was up 8% from last year, which was just a tick under 5 million.
Yeah, I think obviously the rain delay helped. I mean, think about it. This figure that the Indy 500 got, and I've not seen all of the numbers from the weekend because Memorial Day and delays. This number that the Indy 500 got was despite competition with NASCAR, which NASCAR did have rain too, but not until after Indy was over. So, you know, who knows how much bigger that audience would have been. To me, I've seen people comment to this effect already. Should the Indy 500 move permanently to a late afternoon start? No. The Indy 500 has a certain tradition. One, apparently they don't have lights there, which is weird. But the Indy 500 has a certain tradition. And TV ratings are not so important that you're going to just throw out century of tradition just to get a higher number. I don't see that happening. So I would also say out-of-home viewing was clearly higher this year. Oh, and probably important to note, because of the rain, they waived that blackout in Indy. So the numbers that we're seeing maybe are a little misleading. And beyond that, very importantly, out-of-home viewing was going to get a lift because of that Indy audience. There's no way that people don't watch out-of-home more in Indy than anywhere else in the country. So some of this is a little, there's some caveats, but I think very impressive number. Might be the last Indy 500 on NBC. Fox will certainly have the space for it next year. They're not going to have the Coke 600, which moves to Amazon.
Yeah, definitely. And it goes to show you, you know, I actually think John Kosner and Ed Desser yesterday in the Sports Business Journal had a little bit of a guest column where they mentioned how willing NBC compared to the rest of the broadcast networks were to, you know, preempt their primetime coverage and their evening news and all the traditional broadcast channel coverage you'd get from, you know, the evening news on through to primetime. And NBC, you know, probably had to, you know, push back some of that programming. I wasn't watching, but I imagine, given the window for the Indianapolis 500, they probably had to, that probably impacted their evening programming, and it paid off. You know, they had a good number for the Indy 500. It'll be interesting to see how willing they are to compete with Fox for the rights to the race next year and the years beyond that, as this was the last year of their contract. But it'll be sad to see if the Indianapolis 500 leaves NBC. It seems to be such a staple of the network's coverage.
It's only been 6 years, right? It hasn't been that long.
Really?
Oh. Well, NBC does a great job with these one-off events, and so it might seem like they've been there forever. And Tirico, of course, you know, Mike Tirico could show up at, you know, professional bull riding and seem like he's been doing it for 20 years. So that's part of it. But NBC's only had IndyCar full-time and the Indy 500 for, you know, about six-ish years. And Fox, you know, look, Fox has the Daytona 500. You know, they can really establish themselves as the home of the best motorsports, the biggest events. But I would actually be very curious to see. IndyCar's up and F1's up. IndyCar wants broadcast television exposure. But if I'm Amazon, I say, we already have the Coca-Cola 600. Why don't we just get the Monaco Grand Prix and the Indy 500 too? Right? And just own that particular day in motorsports. Now, never going to happen. Because IndyCar wants broadcast television. Even if they were willing to sell the Indy 500 separately, that devalues the rest of that package to the point where it's pointless. And, I mean, if you're going to get the Monaco Grand Prix, you're going to get all of F1. I don't know if Amazon wants to get all of F1, all of IndyCar. It's pointless, but just a little hypothetical I was thinking about, since it is technically possible to do.
All right. Another positive ratings story from the weekend is the NHL's Eastern Conference Finals that, of course, features the New York Rangers, which is a big ratings draw. Comparisons are a little bit wacky from year to year with the NHL playoffs these days as they rotate between TNT and ESPN and /ABC. So this series has the advantage of having some broadcast windows versus the cable windows last year, making for some pretty good comparisons. So you wrote on your website, John, through three games, the Rangers-Panthers Eastern Conference Final is averaging 2.2 million on ESPN and ABC, and that's a 45% increase from last year, which was Panthers-Hurricanes on TNT. A pretty big jump.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, the Rangers are there. Anything compared to Panthers, Hurricanes is going to be up. You'll notice the viewership is actually down slightly from 2 years ago when New York played Tampa Bay. So let's not go crazy. But certainly, if you're the NHL, you're very pleased to have the Rangers in there. And obviously, you're very pleased that New York has won back-to-back overtime games, putting them in a very good position. Worst case scenario now is that New York loses in six. If that happens, at least you get game six on ABC. Obviously, best case scenario is that New York wins in, you know, seven, but you don't want to mess around. You know, baseball messed around last year with the Diamondbacks Phillies, right? They probably would have preferred that ended in five. It went seven. You got the game seven, but then the Phillies lost. Same thing with Pacers Knicks in the NBA. So sometimes you want that series to end quickly if it means getting the right team into the next round. I think ultimately if the Rangers get in there, either matchup, Rangers Oilers or Rangers Stars will do well.
Speaking of series that are ending quickly, I guess this is the negative rating story of this week, a pretty obvious one. The possibility that the NBA will face two conference finals that end in 4-0 sweeps. Obviously, we've already had one, Celtics moving on in four games against the Pacers. Now it comes down to the Western Conference Finals, the Mavericks and Timberwolves. Is this something the NBA at all cares about, is concerned about, or are they still just focused on getting that nearly 3x rights increase that is coming down the pike?
Well, I don't want to sound like T.O.'s old publicist, but the NBA has 75 billion reasons not to worry about the ratings coming up. Look, does the NBA have maybe a problem on its hands with the lack of competition at this point of the postseason? Yeah, second straight year, both conference finals are 3-0. The second straight year. And five of the last six conference finals in the NBA have been 3-0. It's unacceptable. It's also just the way it goes sometimes. You know, the Stanley Cup final was a sweep for four straight years, right, in the 90s. 95, 96, 97, 98. There wasn't even a single game five in those years. So that happens sometimes. But certainly you don't want, you know, all these sweeps. The Pacers lost that series against Boston in game one. They threw it away, dribbled it off their leg, and they never got back up. 90% winning possibility in three out of four games. Ridiculous. As far as the West goes, I just don't get it. I'm surprised because Minnesota has had so much hype this season. A lot of it's been organic. It's not like they were anointed at preseason. They played their way into being perceived as a title contender, and now they're down 3-0. It's very surprising. You know, maybe they'll win today. Maybe the injury to Derek Lively will create a circumstance where they have a window to compete. But I think they're going to get swept. They're on the road, and they have not. I mean, they won Game 7 on the road at Denver, but you know what the real truth is? Denver wasn't that good. Denver wasn't that good. The fact that the Lakers played the Nuggets as hard as they did in those five games, Denver wasn't that good. And beating Denver doesn't mean what we thought it meant. We thought that beating Denver meant Minnesota was the best team in the West. We are obviously not correct about that.
Hypothetically, if this series does end in a sweep, we're going to have over a week of gap between the conference finals ending and the NBA finals starting. How much does that hurt potential viewership for the NBA finals?
I mean, it'll hurt, but you know, there's never been a year where both conference finals ended in sweeps. There was a year pretty recently when one went to five and the other was a sweep. So you only had nine games total. That was 2015. And that was when the Cavaliers with LeBron swept Atlanta and the, the Warriors beat Houston in five. And so the game five with Warriors Rockets was on a Wednesday, which meant you had Thursday to Thursday, nothing. And then the finals got off to a great start. Highest rated game one in ages at that point, with a double digit rating. So yeah, that was LeBron and Steph. But Steph wasn't Steph at that point yet. 2015, this is the first one. And I think this is a good matchup, Boston and Dallas. And I would have said that about Boston Golden State 2 years ago, and we saw how surprisingly low those numbers were. And I think the NBA is healthier now than it was then in 2022. But I don't know. I mean, I really have no idea what the viewership is going to look like for this finals. I mean, I'm not going to be able to come up with a really quality prediction until like game one. But I do think that the layoff won't help. But the layoff is also not the end of the world either. With all due respect to the National Hockey League, we are on the brink of a July preview coming up. It's going to be really, really barren here. Between now and July 26th, 2 months from now, we have like 8 NBA games max, because I think the West Finals ends today, and then you have 7 games in the finals. You have the final games of hockey. I guess what? The U.S. Open of golf?
French Open.
French Open, Wimbledon. No, we're heading straight into the mouth of nothing's going on. And I know the Olympics, obviously, you know, Olympic trials. You have the Olympic trials. But it's going to get slow out here. Believe you me.
All right, John, good podcast. Great to reflect on the life of Bill Walton. Why don't we go ahead and close it out for this week?
All right. Well, you know, as we head out, I would like to, I shared this on social media, but I would like to play one of my favorite Bill Walton clips as we head out. This is from Cold Pizza. And the prompt is that Dana Jacobson simply asks Bill Walton one question. And as many others have experienced, you ask Bill Walton one question and you get many, many, many answers.
We welcome in ESPN NBA analyst, Hall of Famer Bill Walton. Bill, let's start talking about the Suns. Amari Stoudemire coming back last night, 6 points in about 11 minutes of action. How did he look to you?
Dana, from the Valley of the Sun, I am perched high above the desert floor, and the red streaks of the morning dawn are illuminating this glorious sky. I'm perusing Edward Abbey's Desert Solitude here, and on opening day, the songs are just running through the smoking crater. I've been listening to Bob Dylan's newest album, Modern Times, which is absolutely remarkable. Thunder on the Mountain, Spirit on the Water, Rolling and Tumbling, which all go to describe Amari Stoudemire, but the songs that I can't get out of my mind today. John Fogerty, center field. Put me in, coach. I'm ready to play today. Or Bob Dylan's New Morning. And Dana, like you, I'm just so happy to be alive underneath this sky of blue on this new morning. What could be better than opening day?
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.